I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events, major elections, world wars, scientific breakthroughs. But we also bring you into the smaller, behind-the-scenes stories, the unsung heroes, secret meetings, even personal grudges that changed the course of history. Listen to and follow History This Week, an Odyssey podcast in partnership with the History Channel. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
St. Louis is home for conservative talk.
You're listening to The Mark Reardon Show.
We're going to have a little fun with my friend Dan Buffa, movie critic extraordinaire, and take a look back at the anniversary of Pulp Fiction, 30 years. Also, it's the 20th anniversary of a really good film called Garden State with Zach Braff. He wrote and directed that. Natalie Portman, a young Natalie Portman, was in that. We'll get to that, plus an audio cut of the day. Right now, Jonathan Martin, Politico's senior columnist, one of the best political reporters in the country, here with us just a couple of weeks before this huge presidential race. J. Mart, how are you this afternoon?
Hey, thanks for having me. Good to be back.
Let me start with this question here. I tweeted this morning. Are you aware if either presidential candidate has taken a stand on reply all email responses? Because we had an issue with that in my building today. And I just feel like there are two kinds of people in the world, Jonathan. People who send reply alls and people who don't. And I think if a presidential candidate took a stand on this, it might swing some votes.
If one of these candidates could do something about the transfer rules in college sports, the lack of on-site rental car facilities at America's airports.
Holiday after the Super Bowl. Monday for the holiday after Super Bowl, right?
There these we are go. All, and yeah. Reply to all emails, man. They'd get 400 electoral college votes.
We would have a landslide. But I don't think we're going to have a landslide. But what's your gut check right now? What are you seeing? Because, you know, from my seat here in a radio studio in St. Louis, it appears as if Kamala Harris has lost the momentum. It looks like Trump is closing strong. It looks like Michigan and Wisconsin might be in play for Trump. And then it still looks like it's all about Pennsylvania. So how do you assess this race with just a couple weeks to go?
Things are right. I mean, there's no question that she had a good convention, strong first debate. And then she kind of ran out of big moments, kind of tentpole events, if you will, that she could do what she does best, which is prep for 10 days and, you know, crash a bunch of good lines. And I think she's not as good at the day-to-day rigors of campaigning as she's a big event. And so I think, frankly, she's been hurt by that. And Trump has waged a really strong campaign on the airwaves. His commercials, the mail's been strong. I think it sort of portrayed her as a liberal. And she, frankly, has not found ways to break from Biden and appeal to the center of the country and reassure voters in the political center that she governed as a moderate in ways that I think she still has to do more.
What do you make of this here? By the way, are you with either of the campaigns right now?
Not at the moment.
Okay.
I will be soon.
She's in Michigan, and Peter Alexander, I'm sure you know Peter from NBC, asked her a question here.
President Biden said this week that every president has to cut their own path. What is one policy that you would have done differently over these last 3.5 years than President Biden?
I mean, to be very candid with you, even including Mike Pence, vice presidents are not critical of their presidents. I think that really actually, in terms of the tradition of it and also just going forward, it does not make for a productive and important relationship.
Yeah, I'm not sure that was the best way to answer that question.
Yeah, missed opportunity.
Yeah,
it's
right.
A missed opportunity. Yeah, look, I mean, she's running with the burden of an unpopular incumbent president who the country did not want to run for re-election. And that president effectively gave her the opening to break from him in some way, shape, or form. This is big boy stuff. This is politics. He's going to get over it. I don't know why she'd have a better answer there.
Was there, I get that the question is tough, but, you know, I guess maybe some of this is, let's go back to Bret Baier. Let me ask you this question. Why do you think she did the Bret Baier interview? What was the reason for that?
Oh, I think she knows that she has to appeal more to center and even center right voters who are not enthused about Trump but are not yet sold on voting for her. I mean, I think there's a big chunk of voters out there who are never going to vote for Trump, who were basically, you know, Republicans or kind of former Republicans. But right now, they're going to write somebody in or skip the top line. They're not going to vote for her. And she's trying to get those folks in the boat. And that's why she's in Fox.
Well, what are you seeing with, because this is being discussed a little bit more here with the demographics, African-American men, Hispanic men in particular, where are they going to potentially tip the balance here? Again, I've never made the case that, you know, you're going to have that much of an increase in African-American votes for Trump. But again, if they stay home, the effect is similar.
Well, and this is a margins game, so everything matters, including her doing slightly better with Black and Hispanic men, especially working class voters. Yeah, the big question here is, can she overwhelm Trump with female voters in a way that her erosion with men, including Black and Hispanic men, is not going to matter? That is the big question.
Wasn't the Al Smith dinner another miss for her from this perspective? Look, I thought a lot of the lines, Jonathan, you weren't there. Were you there last night?
No, I was
okay.
Not.
So, you know, a lot of the lines were pretty good. But my criticism of Trump would be he didn't read the script beforehand. If you read the script, you could have delivered the jokes a little better. But the lines were good. But if Kamala Harris decides to do the Al Smith dinner, she's got, you know, 90% of Hollywood, if not 98% of Hollywood comedy writers that probably could have written some pretty good material. Right. So why skip that?
Wow. And not just that, but she's proven in the debate and at her convention that she's capable of delivering a good line or two in the moment. So
I would agree.
Yeah, like, I'm not sure why she didn't do it, because that could have lived on the internet for days or weeks afterward.
What are your thoughts on Pennsylvania right now? Does it all come down to Pennsylvania?
No, I mean, I think it's more complicated than that. Pennsylvania is certainly central, but she's got a dogfight on her hand in Michigan and Wisconsin. And look, I don't think Trump is a lock in Georgia, in North Carolina. So, I mean, I think that there's more states that matter. But there's no question that if she loses Pennsylvania, this gets harder for her.
What about the Senate races? And what, you know, because there's interesting races when you go out west and you think about Nevada and Arizona, where Trump could certainly win both those states, but both Republican Senate candidates are likely to not win.
Yeah, look, the Republicans are sort of underperforming, I think, this year in the Senate. This is a great map for them. The only two states Democrats can pick up this year are Texas and Florida, which are red states that they're almost certainly not going to get. You know, Republicans are probably going to take control of the Senate, but boy, it's going to be 51-52, and I think it could be 55-56. But the candidate quality is not great, and a lot of these Democratic incumbents had a financial advantage for a long time.
Like and I've always been someone, Jonathan, who has preached that the quality of the candidate matters. And, you know, you can go back in time and look at some of these that haven't been successful. And that's exactly what's happening in Arizona and Nevada right now, right?
No question about it. No question about it. Yeah. Look, this should be a good Republican year. All right. Unpopular president, anger about inflation and immigration, anti-status quo against the party in power. The only reason that it's not necessarily a great one is because, you know, Trump turns off a lot of voters in the political center, you know, moderate, and because the abortion issue is fairly galvanizing. And so I think those two issues keep Democrats in the game. But still, it should be largely a good Republican year.
So there's been a lot of attention this week. I'm going to be honest with you. I talk about these culture issues a lot. I talk about because we had a clinic here in St. Louis. Jamie Reed was a whistleblower at WashU and Children's Hospital. So the trans issue and the women's sports issue, that resonates with me. It resonates with my audience. There's an ad out there that I think has resonated with a lot of people who are not on the far left on that particular issue. Is that having an impact, do you think?
Well, I was talking to a Democratic ad maker a couple of hours ago who was lamenting that very ad, you know, because it does appeal to the gut of a lot of voters, including people who don't follow politics that closely, who just see that and don't like it. And by the way, voters who I think are not just on the right, but some voters in the center, too, include across racial lines. So, yeah, it's a potent ad, and you talk to the Democrats privately, and they're obviously focused on it.
I'll close with this final question here. Post-election, do you have any plans for our friend Scott Jennings' growing ego after his superstardom that has occurred on CNN? Because, wow, that guy's taken off, hasn't he?
I'm happy for Scott. He's a good guy, and he's a smart fellow. I think he's enjoying this bit, the spotlight, don't you?
Yeah, I do. And it's so funny because you don't know the connection here, but I worked in Milwaukee a long time ago, and I would go to work in the morning and I'd listen to WHAS in Louisville, which is 840. And I love the station because I would go to a lot of Kentucky Derbies. And there was a guy who did the overnight show named Joe Arnold, and I would listen to him. And then I found out after years, Joe introduced me about 7 years ago to Jennings. And here's how he positioned. He goes, "Hey, remember when you were listening to me on that overnight show? My news guy was Scott Jennings." So this goes back 20 years ago. Jennings, 2 in the morning, 3 in the morning, doing news. They're talking about stuff on talk radio in Louisville. Yeah. So we kind of go way back.
Scott's a small town boy from Western Kentucky and went to Louisville on a scholarship thanks to Mitch McConnell, and he's done well because he's got real talent. So just don't tell him we said that.
No, though, I know. Right? And I told him I'm going to call him the KJP of Kentucky. He didn't think that was a compliment, so I might not do that.
I love it. I love it.
All right, J-Mart, listen, enjoy the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
All right, we'll talk.
Thanks a bunch,
take care.
Man.
Jonathan Martin from Politico, who, you know, we criticize a lot of journalism. I criticize a lot of journalism. One of the things I love about Jonathan is he actually reports. He keeps it pretty much down the middle. He has a lot of great insight because he talks to a lot of different people. Let me play that ad. I played it during the roundtable a couple hours ago. But this is something that it's having an impact. I don't know that it's like the Willie Horton ad, but certainly people are responding to this. It's a problem for the Democrats and certainly for Kamala Harris.
He murdered a father of three, sentenced to life in prison. Kamala Harris pushed to use tax dollars to pay for his sex change.
I made sure that they changed the policy so that every transgender inmate would have access.
It sounds insane because it is insane. Kamala was the first to help pay for a prisoner's sex change.
The power that I had, I used it in a way that was about pushing for the movement, frankly, and the agenda.
Kamala's agenda is they, them, not you.
Now, you might remember, if you paid some attention to the Bret Baier interview in when she was asked about this. And what I said was, and I really do feel this way, I think it was a bit of a miss on Bret. And you know, if I had to guess, and I don't know Bret, you know, I know Kill Me pretty well, but Bret probably is a little bummed out that he didn't follow up on the trans question, because she kind of started talking and he never got to ask the question about women's sports in particular. And I would have loved to have heard what her answer was going to be. But what she said was she tried to spin it in this direction. Well, you know, this happened during the Trump administration, too. And the New York Times actually took time to do a piece on this, how this policy occurred during the Trump administration. OK, fair enough. But here's the difference. OK, there's a big difference. One of the presidential candidates has advocated for that, thinks it's a good idea, is now lying about it because she wants to be president, and is a radical on that issue. It's been well established. The other, who was president, is totally and completely 100,000% against that policy, as most sane Americans are. And he's made that clear. But I love that the New York Times has to go to bat. They got to go to bat for Kamala Harris and show that, oh, this happened under the Trump administration. It's always about Trump, right? It's always about Trump, even though he's been gone for 4 years. Now, I played some of the audio earlier from last night. The Al Smith dinner was pretty good. And Jim Gaffigan, who's been killing it as Tim Walz on SNL.
Cardinal Dolan is also a friend of mine, and I would never put him on the spot. But Cardinal Dolan, I'm curious. The Pope did say that this election is a choice between the lesser of two evils. And so, two-part question. One, do you agree? And two, who's more evil? All right, I'll come back to you.
He seemed to be, by the way, Dolan, if you watch the video, and this is what I like about the Al Smith dinner. Look, Schumer's right next to Trump. Trump's kind of, you know, tapping him on the shoulder, giving him grief, and Schumer's even laughing. Cardinal Dolan was laughing. He even said that it was a bad idea for Kamala not to be there.
She won't be imbalanced because, sadly, Kamala Harris isn't coming. It's a shame because the nature of the evening is to bring people together.
Right.
The nature of the evening is civility, patriotism, humor. Mm-hmm. It's not a campaign speech. Mm-hmm. It's not a campaign stop.
So I have some really good audio and maybe some lines you've heard already, but we'll save those for audio cut of the day. It is the 30th anniversary of Pulp Fiction. My friend Dan Buffa, film critic here in St. Louis. We're going to recognize that and talk some movies coming up next.
Where the paper rain, and half of my heart is the part of a man who's never truly loved anything.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Ladies and gentlemen, now the moment you've all been waiting for, it's a world famous Jackrabbit Slim's Twist Contest. Now let's meet our first contestants here this evening. Young lady, what is your name?
Mrs. Mia Wallace.
And how about your fella here?
Vincent Vega.
All right, let's see what you can do. Take it away.
That movie is now 30 years old. October 14th, it was earlier this week, Pulp Fiction celebrated its 30th anniversary. And, you know, we got to throw in a little Chuck Berry since that scene included Chuck Berry. My friend Dan Buffa from Dose of Buffa, and he writes about movies and has for a long time here in St. Louis. I thought you were the perfect person to celebrate this anniversary because you're a big Tarantino fan. I mean, how could you not be as a film fan, a big Tarantino fan? How are you, Dan?
I'm good, man. I remember the Entertainment Weekly cover. They had all of them on it, standing there, and you're like, oh, Travolta, and Samuel, who's that guy? And then Harvey Keitel and Uma Thurman. I just think it was just the way he told that story, how it was all fractioned off, the little subtails, and then they all kind of come together, like how, you know, Travolta's character insults Bruce Willis's character. Then they have a nice little interaction later on, and how dialogue kind of took on a different meaning in Tarantino's films.
You're a little younger than I am, but see, I was a fan because of True Romance, which he wrote, and then I loved Reservoir Dogs. That's a little bit of a tough movie for some people to watch,
tough,
but that kind of put him on the map. I mean, people in Hollywood knew about him because of True Romance, and he wrote that film. You know what, Dan, you know what sucks? There was a book that I read a couple of decades ago about True Romance and Quentin Tarantino, and for the love of God, I don't know what, it was such a great book, and I've Googled it, and I've tried to put it together. I don't know what book it was. If anyone knows, please tell me. But so he's on the radar, and then here's something I didn't know until this week, and this is shameful. Variety does this story on the 30th anniversary. We were just talking about this. You knew this. Danny DeVito was one of the big producers behind this, right?
He was, because he was a big fan of Reservoir Dogs, so he had essentially told Quentin Tarantino, whatever you do next, you know, I want to do. And it's just a movie that it played so well because Reservoir Dogs kind of came on and just stormed the palace, but then we all thought, could he do it again? And even to this day, you know, 2 hours and 34 minutes, that movie, it doesn't feel like 2 hours and 34 minutes.
I mean, it's just one of the best movies
in
history.
And this is another great story. If you go on IMDb, they have all this trivia. And so apparently in the scene where Christopher Walken tells young Butch Coolidge about his dad and where he had to hide the watch, Walken's pause at the end is because he had forgotten his lines, and I think he recovers, and Tarantino was like, we're going to leave
that in. Kept the take. He kept the take.
Yeah, and he did. I remember thinking about it. He kind of had a pause. So I think people just, I mean, we mentioned before we got on here, $8.5 million
to make. The budget was $8.5 million.
And they made $213.
Right. And, so here's a quote from the Variety piece. Danny DeVito says, because again, and Lawrence Bender was a big name in Hollywood. He produced this. So Reservoir Dogs is on their radar. They're kind of impressed by this guy. And again, because of his writing with True Romance, too. So Danny DeVito says, I spoke to him during that year, checking in just, how's everything? Is it coming along? This is after Reservoir Dogs. And then there was a doorbell ring, and there was a package, a manila envelope with 155 pages in it. I swear to God, I always like to think it was still warm. And the top page read, Pulp Fiction by Quentin Tarantino, final draft. Danny DeVito says, I tucked myself into a sofa with a cup of tea and I laughed my ass off. I loved it from the very beginning to the very end. The big question was, it was 155 pages.
Yeah.
He says, I had this woman I worked with, Wilma. We don't have enough Wilmas anymore,
Dan.
Wouldn't you agree with that?
It's a great name.
Who was my script supervisor, and she used to time things for me. And you usually go a page a minute, and the final running time of the movie was 154 minutes. You know, that sometimes can be, well, you know what's funny about that? Back then, that was, you know, kind of staggering. Then they started making a lot of movies that were that long.
Now, that's like the average. I think back then it was a little bit long, but I think all the stories behind it, how he went to Bruce Willis's house, and he kind of had to convince him that he couldn't play Vincent Vega. He wanted him to play Butch. And then De Niro wanted to play this and that, and all the people that Tarantino goes into circles with. So I don't know. It's
a
classic.
Okay, so a little bit of that on the casting. This is interesting. So here's a name from the past that, you know, has you can't say his name anymore, but Harvey Weinstein was a big player. Miramax,
big player.
Right? Big player. So Harvey Weinstein is given the script, and, you know, DeVito, they pitched the project, and he says, yeah, we'll do this with Daniel Day-Lewis. Because he had just won an award for My Left Foot. So he was kind of hot at that point, right? And DeVito says, the director, no one knows who Tarantino really is at this point, right? I mean, he's not that name.
He's a newbie.
He goes, the director wants John Travolta. I told this kid I've got final cut plus cast approval. I think he called me, DeVito goes, I think Harvey called me every name in the book, but of course, Quentin got what he wanted, and he was absolutely right, and the rest is history. So let's play a couple of the, this is just classic, right?
And you know what they call a quarter pounder with cheese in Paris?
They don't call it a quarter pounder with cheese?
Oh, man, they got the metric system. They wouldn't know the f*** a quarter pounder is.
And what do they call it?
They call it Royale with cheese.
Royale with cheese.
That's right.
What do they call a Big Mac?
Well, Big Mac's a Big Mac, but they call it Le Big Mac.
Le Big Mac. What do they call a Whopper?
I don't know. I didn't go on a Burger King. You know what they put on French fries in Holland instead of ketchup?
What?
Mayonnaise.
God damn.
I seen him do it, man. They f***ing drown him in his
So that's just like a casual conversation that then turns into this.
What does Marcellus Wallace look like?
What?
What country you from?
What?
What ain't no country I ever heard of? They speak English and what?
What?
English, m***er, do you speak it?
Yes.
Then you know what I'm saying.
Yes.
Describe what Marcellus Wallace looks like.
What?
Say what again? Say what again? I dare you. I double dare you, m***er. Say what one more time.
You know, Dan, this is easy to say at this point because, you know, so much history and time has passed, but that was one of those scenes that really jumped out as a filmmaker and the talent that he had. Because, look, we had seen movies in the 70s, we'd seen violent movies, but there was just something about even the compare and the contrast and the juxtaposition there with the casual conversation about a Royale with cheese that turns into a brutally violent episode in that apartment with Frank Whaley.
Yeah, and then, of course, their interaction in the apartment has to do with the burger. It's basically one of the coolest parts of a character eating on screen ever is where Samuel Jackson just picks up his burger and just starts eating it, and he goes, I get something to wash this down. He finishes his drink, and then it goes sinister so quickly. And the whole scene is really just, it's like Samuel L. Jackson is like the point guard of it. He just pushes it.
So let me share some, because this variety piece, which inspired me having you in here this afternoon, was very interesting because I'll put this up on Twitter here after our segment, because they went and they talked to like 100 different people that were connected with this film. You know, the grips, the producers, the actors, the film, all that stuff.
Takes a village to make that kind of
movie. Exactly. So, you know, they featured in this piece that was out on Monday some of the responses, and some of them came from the principals. So Travolta says, the last success I experienced, this is kind of fun to do the history here and you think about it. You remember what his movie right before Pulp Fiction was? Look Who's Talking. So he said, think about that, right? He goes, getting the Pulp offer was certainly a next level upper echelon opportunity, more along the lines of Oscar nomination type performances of Saturday Night Fever and Blowout Integrity. I was one of the favorite actors growing up on Welcome Back, Kotter, Saturday Night Fever, Grease, and Blowout, and he wanted to work with me. And I think it helped his being a big Pauline Kael fan, who is a film critic, and my being one of her favorite actors. So he raised the bar for me, gave me a second chance at a high-end career, one that he always wanted me to have. And oh my God, did that knock it out of the park for Travolta, right?
Yeah, and I think, I mean, looking in one movie, what he did, he showed us Samuel L. Jackson. He kind of really gave us a new shade of Bruce Willis. You know, he played a hero, but not this kind of guy. And then here's Travolta, and then here's Uma Thurman, and then Harvey Keitel. Just the way that he introduces talents, and also, like, you know, Travolta kind of brushes off talents that we already know.
So Tim Roth is also an interesting character in this place, Pumpkin, but he said, I didn't know this. So Quentin did not write Pumpkin for Tim Roth. He wrote Pumpkin for Bruce Willis.
Yeah.
And he said there was this fun thing that happened, and I think that brought about the Pumpkin and Honey Bunny situation, which was I got to know Amanda Plummer a little bit. She had the premiere of The Fisher King, which, by the way, that's a great movie coming
up.
I suggested that I would be her date. We went to the premiere, and there was Terry Gilliam and Quentin. I got to talking with Quentin. I remember him saying, I want to be in a film with Amanda. Or no, he said to him, I want to be in a film with Amanda, but she has to have a gun in her hand because the idea of Amanda Plummer having a gun in her head is truly terrifying. And sure enough, he wrote it. So just kind of weird there. And, you know, when I was pulling the let's just play one more clip here, because when I was pulling this audio earlier, you can maybe, because we know Quentin's voice right now, but you can just hear his voice in the script, can't you?
Yeah.
Because that's just the way that Quentin is, and this was legendary.
Read the Bible, Brent.
Yes!
Well, there's this passage I got memorized. Sort of fits this occasion. Ezekiel 25:17. The path of the righteous man is beset on all sides by the inequities of the selfish and the tyranny of evil men. Blessed is he who in the name of charity and goodwill shepherds the weak through the valley of darkness, for he is truly his brother's keeper and the finder of lost children. And I will strike down upon thee with great vengeance and furious anger those who attempt to poison and destroy my brothers. And you will know my name is the Lord when I lay my vengeance upon thee.
Yeah, that didn't turn out very well for Brett, did it?
No,
Frank
did not.
Whaley, who was great in that scene, he didn't last very long in the movie, did he? He goes, when the film was released, I was out of the country working, and he says he got several calls from people saying it was the greatest movie they had ever seen. And when I got back home, I was living in New York City, and it was a week or two after the film opened. I hadn't seen it, he says, but I was being recognized on the subway, and that had never happened to him at the time. He said, I've been working for a good 5-6 years in films, big films, never recognized.
No.
That completely turned things around.
Yeah, I just think, I mean, look at it, a very small little bit role gets people recognized on the subway. I mean, and he's an iconic part of that iconic scene. So even the guys who get shot get remembered.
So it's interesting to me, too, that, you know, from a filmmaking standpoint, I think it's easy to say this, like, where are the Pulp Fictions? Or I would even say some of Quentin's, like a good arsenal of Quentin's movies, there aren't films like that today. Maybe it's because there aren't Quentin Tarantino's today. I don't know, Dan.
I really think that a lot of directors do not get final cut these days. And so,
well, that's,
you know,
true.
I would like to see what some movies were. I mean, if it showed more of a director's vision. But the fact is that, you know, there are few...
Studios have control.
Few Tarantinos. Maybe Christopher Nolan. I don't think anybody else. Maybe a few more get like, hey, my cut is going to be what audiences see. And I think that robs of it a lot of authenticity. And then it's kind of more manufactured. A lot of movies try to resemble a Tarantino film. And I think Guy Ritchie did it the best with Snatch. But that's a 1 in about 100 chances. So... But it's just the control he had, and I don't think a lot of directors get it.
Where would you put him? Now, where is he right now? Because he had kind of retired, but where would you put him in the echelon of these great filmmakers?
Because
for me, he's probably at the very top.
He is. I mean, I think every time I want to think like Scorsese and Spielberg, there's a lot of their movies I like and don't love. You know, I don't love every single one of Tarantino's films. I mean, like Django, I'm not in love with, but it's still a very good movie. I mean... Anything, Jackie Brown may not hit as high as Pulp Fiction, but it's still a very good movie. So he has to be in the top three because he hasn't really made a dud. And I think maybe that's why he didn't want to do this film critic thing with Brad Pitt. Maybe he saw it being a dud and he's like, I'm not making a dud.
I would say, like, for me, I was a little divided on The Hateful Eight. Although,
yeah. Watching it, though, helped me. I watched
right.
it a couple more times. I was like, because everybody pops up in that movie. Like, it's just... You know, oh my gosh, this guy, that guy, and then her, and then the second time and third time you go, okay, now it's making more sense. For me, David Carradine's speech at the end of Kill Bill 2, comparing Uma Thurman's character, I think, to Superman, it's just like, it's those kind of things you don't see.
Well, and you know, I'll tell you something else about Quentin, and I interviewed him one time, and it was for Inglourious Basterds. And here, Dan, you know, Dan's a member of the Critics' Choice. I have been. I'm not a voting member right now, but I was back then, and I was doing junkets. So I went to Hollywood that weekend, and who was the Spy Kids movies? Robert Rodriguez, right?
Rodriguez,
so
yeah.
Here's what's funny about that whole weekend. This is, you know, what, 13, 14 years ago. Mm. They were doing, a lot of times they do this with the junkets, and a junket is when they invite media members out to interview the cast, yep. directors, et cetera, and you
Smooth,
sit there.
Yeah.
And then I would put this stuff on Channel 4. You know, I'd bring it back, and Channel
sure,
4
yeah.
would air it. And they did some unique things back then every once in a while. And when the Spy Kids movie was coming, I think it was the third one or the second, the first one. They said, why don't you have, I had a son who was probably 14 at the time, who's now, you know, 27, maybe was younger than that. He was able to go with me. And he got to interview the cast of the Spy Kids, like James Spader and stuff like that.
That's great.
But I had to leave him at the hotel because we had two screenings. We had the one screening for Spy Kids.
Yep.
And then the movie studio had all this, you know, they had babysitters back at the hotel and supervision. And then we went into a screening of Inglourious Basterds.
Oh, okay.
And we all this group of, I think there were about, wasn't a very big group. There was probably about 25 to 30 people in this screening room.
Yeah.
And Dan, that was... And I think it would have been like this for Pulp Fiction for me, too, probably, had I seen it in this setting.
Yeah.
But we're in this room. No one really knew much about what this movie was going to be about. Everyone knew the reputation of Quentin Tarantino. And that movie just completely kicked your ass in such a good way.
It did.
The whole time you investigate, you know, you got to learn who Christoph Waltz was.
Yeah.
And that was just an incredible, incredible movie.
Yeah.
And then there's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And we both... I just deeply love that.
To me, Cliff Booth may arguably be Brad Pitt, one of his best characters, because it allows him to do a little bit of Brad Pitt, and then he kind of has a little bit of crazy in him. And I think Brad Pitt, as we know from Fight Club and Thelma and Louise and all those movies he's been in, he can play crazy. And I think that there are certain actors who get to work with certain directors, and I really hope whatever he does next, I think Brad Pitt and Clooney should. He needs to do another movie with George Clooney.
You know, yeah, that would be great. By the way, sometimes you don't get to interview everyone on the cast. So because that was such a big cast, I interviewed Christoph and a bunch of the others, but it was either Brad or Quentin, and we didn't have a say. I drew the Quentin straw, and I was so glad that I did.
Yeah.
But what's funny, Dan, is I swear to God, I think I asked him, I had 5 minutes, right? This is five what you minutes. Get. You have five or six minutes.
Five or
I
six
think
minutes.
I might have asked him one question.
Yeah,
and I think the question was about, you know, the revisionist history claims because, you know, he rewrote the history in a very creative way. I gave him all the license to do that, but he explained himself in, you know, the answer to my question. But again, it went on for about 6 minutes.
Yeah,
because he's just about as weird in person as you would imagine, which makes him so brilliant, I think.
Yeah, I think those great creators, I mean, when they're dealing with the media and trying to explain themselves, they're going to come off a little weird, especially if they really let themselves go. I would love to see him just kind of uncorked and not really in a proper interview and see what else comes out of him. I mean, imagine what this guy can just dish on in the moment.
Oh, absolutely. By the way, we don't have a lot of time to spend on it because we were doing the 30th anniversary of Pulp Fiction, but it's the 20th anniversary of this movie, Garden State.
Doing anything right now?
Can you elaborate on doing anything?
No, just I know this guy, Jesse, bought this mansion that's right up here, and he wants me to come visit him, but I don't want to stay very long. So I was thinking, like, if you came too, I could just have to take you home when I'm ready to go.
Wow. That's pretty damn random of you, Andrew.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you. Can I use you?
No.
It's a Hollywood night.
No, come on. It's not like that. It'll be fun. Come on. I'll tell you what, we can have, like a signal. Like... When you pull on your ear, that's the code, and then I'll be like, oh, I gotta take her home, and then I will go.
Can we have code names, too?
So that was a little bit of a long clip, but I love Natalie Portman in that movie. Peter Sarsgaard was great, and it was a special, special movie from 2004, and Zach Braff, who is now best known, I think, for his commercials.
Yeah, and Scrubs, but... You know, he jumps onto the scene. I think he directed that film.
He wrote and directed it.
It was just a really good, like, if you want to use feel-good movie with a little bit of an edge, because I think it gave Natalie Portman a great role, too.
Oh, absolutely. But and, you know, he was asked about, you know, they're always asked about sequels and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And he defiantly said, no, you know what, that movie, and I'm so glad, it stands on its own.
It stands on its own.
There's no need to touch it,
Leave it alone, because if you make a bad sequel... That's going to be stinking more than how brilliant your first film was.
Exactly. What are you liking these days?
Man, to be honest, I mean, what's coming out and that I'm kind of really excited for is I'm looking at your notes, and there's two movies that came out today. There's a Brolin film.
Yeah, we talked about it a little bit earlier.
And then Woman of the Hour. For me, man, I am just rewatching older movies. I watched Pulp Fiction. I watched Steven Spielberg's The Terminal on Netflix, a very underappreciated Tom Hanks movie. I watched finally Furiosa, and I didn't really, I didn't get it as much as everybody else did. So, I mean, I don't know. I think I'm still waiting to be thrilled. The biggest thing I've seen this year that I've loved, it's probably on demand, is Sing Sing, with Coleman Domingo.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
About the Sing Sing, the prison theater program. And there's real people who participated in the program, who did time, or in the movie. And that movie, kind of like Garden State, Pulp Fiction, kind of came out of nowhere. And it's got a great cast. Coleman Domingo can't be bad if he tried. But, I mean, other than that, man, it's been kind of a year that there's been some good movies, but there's been a lot of, like, I wasn't a huge fan of Dune 2. We go back to that. But I'm hoping, like, the next couple months, I think Brad Pitt's got a racing movie coming out soon. But for me, I'm kind of waiting to be thrilled. I'm hoping the end of the year brings something worth watching.
No, it's kind of sad for me. I always kind of say the pandemic killed my film reviewing career, and I'm at peace with that because I was pretty active until 2020. But I also lost interest because there were so many movies. I don't want to drag into the politics and stuff like this, but so many of the social issues, blah, blah, blah. Give me a damn entertaining movie like Garden State, right?
Well, yeah. Well, here's a couple that I really want to see. I want to see Demi Moore in The Substance. I heard that she's really good about Hollywood and image, and she's kind of a performance to watch.
There's a comeback that's been waiting to happen for a while.
A real kind of fun action movie I'm going to hopefully watch this weekend with Dave Bautista called The Killer's Game, where he plays a hitman who puts a hit on himself because he thinks he's dying from cancer, and he finds out that he got the wrong scans, and he has to fight off everybody else.
Interesting.
Yeah.
We'll leave with Chuck Berry since he brought us in. 30th anniversary Pulp Fiction. Dan, I meant to put it on last night, but I got caught up in baseball and football. I'm going to put it on this weekend.
Put it on, man, and just watch it in segments. It's such a great movie.
Good to see you, man.
Yeah, you too. Folks, it goes to show you never can tell.
Saying what you're thinking, Mark Reardon.
All right, well, we're wrapping up another week, and we're getting very close to the election. If you missed the roundtable this afternoon, we had a feisty one as usual. You can always go back and use the Odyssey app and the rewind function. Go back to just about 3:07. Jane joined me. We also had State Rep Donna Behringer and GOP consultant and, fire breather on politics, Greg Keller. So you can go back and check that out. We'll be back on Monday. I have to do audio cut of the day. We'll feature some of last night's Al Smith dinner.
Stand by. Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
I thought there were some pretty good lines last night. Trump probably could have delivered them a little better, but the material was pretty good. If I can get it to play.
I'd like to thank our MC this evening, Jim Gaffigan. Most recently, Jim has been playing Tim Walz on Saturday Night Live. And that'll be a very short gig, I hope, Jim. But it was fun while it lasted.
All right, this might be my favorite, though.
I used to think the Democrats were crazy for saying that men have periods. But then I met Tim Walz.
I mean, that's the winner of the night for me. Have a great weekend, everybody. Let's go Mizzou. Hopefully they get a victory tomorrow. I'm not quite as confident as I was a few weeks ago. We'll see you Monday.
I'm Sally Helm with the podcast History This Week. In each episode, we serve as your eyes and ears into history's biggest events and the lesser told stories, ones you might not even know happened. Find History This Week on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.